St. Agnes Eve, ah, bitter chill it was. The owl, for all his feathers, was a cold. The hare limped trembling through the frozen grass, and silent was the flock in woolly fold. Numb were the beadsman's fingers while he told his rosary, and while his frosted breath, like pious incense from a censer old, seemed taking flight for heaven without a death. Past the sweet virgin's picture, while his prayers he saith. You're listening to the After Dinner Scholar from Wyoming Catholic College, and this is your host, Dr. Jim Tonkowicz. With those lines, John Keats began his poem, The Eve of St. Agnes. A beadsman was someone whose duty it was to pray for his benefactor, the beads being the beads of the rosary. And as in the chapel the beadman prays, in the adjacent castle, Keats describes Madeline's love for Porphyro, her family's great enemy. Later that night, Porphyro arrives at the castle and finds his way to Madeline's bedroom. The two declare their love for each other, and they run off together. Dr. Glenn Arbery and Dr. Tiffany Schubert got together, online of course, to discuss the poem for the benefit of Wyoming Catholic College juniors listening at home. Here's what they had to say.
So Dr. Schubert, your question about the Rime of the Ancient Mariner on the discussion board the other day got me thinking about the medieval elements in Coleridge, for sure, but also in Keats, because Keats is really full of this same kind of imaginative dimension. I wonder, you know, how you're perceiving this. I mean, you're a medievalist and, you know, coming to these romantic poets with this particular perspective must be really interesting for you.
Yeah, it is. I'm really struck by, in someone like Keats and the Eve of St. Agnes, the blend of the medieval and the modern, that he gives such a medieval atmosphere with the references to the Virgin, to knights and ladies, the whole language of courtly love, right? This sort of depiction of courtly love as this worshipful activity. And yet there's this sense of, in something, certainly in like Eve of St. Agnes, this modern tension between the dream world and the real world, and the sense that maybe there's a kind of disappointment that the real world brings. So infuses this medieval atmosphere with this modern concern and modern anxiety.
Yeah, I see that particularly with the character of Porphyro, who seems to be disappointed that Madeline has the kind of belief that she does. He seems himself to be more disenchanted, if I could put it that way, in keeping with our favorite term. Than Madeline is. But I mean, yeah, but as you say, the medieval atmosphere is pretty terrific. That opening, you know, with the old beadsman, and that coldest stanza in English literature, as somebody put it, you know, the first one with the hare limp trembling through the frozen grass, you know, all those things are really helpful in kind of establishing this atmosphere of a medieval world, very much in contrast to the modern one.
Yeah, that coldness, that makes me think of Sir Gawain and the Green Knight.
Yeah.
C.S. Lewis says that poem gave him a feel for coldness that no other poem had.
The Eve of St. Agnes, or
Sir Gawain, sorry, yeah, Gawain. Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, yeah, so that sense of situating action within a kind of cold atmosphere is profound.
Right.
Yeah, so the choice of weather as a kind of medieval,
yeah,
the sort of, yeah, medieval to the whole of it.
And Keats realizes it so terrifically. I mean, the old beadsman is walking along through the church and looking at those knights and ladies off in the side chapels and thinking how cold they must be in their armor. You know, Keats has that wonderful way of making the images work. I wonder, you know, if you sensed, as I did, the presence of the rhyme of the Ancient Mariner to this poem. Even at the beginning, you know, I think of the old beadsman overhearing all the loud laughter and the gathering of the crowd, you know, in the castle. And it's sort of like the noise of the wedding that's going on with the Ancient Mariner at the beginning of Coleridge's poem. I may just be thinking that because we just read it.
Yeah, no, it makes a lot of sense. I definitely felt it more with La Belle Dame Sans Merci.
Uh-huh.
That's when uh-huh. I was reading that. I felt the presence of the Rhyme of the Ancient Mariner there when you have the opening conversation. But yeah, I think that it's there in the Eve of St. Agnes as well. That sense of eeriness and uncanniness that both Coleridge and Keats seem to see in the medieval setting and really draw out, as if the medieval setting allows them to unnerve their modern audiences.
And Keats in particular seems to draw on the world of fairy. And he spells it more or less like Spencer does, F-A-E-R-Y. I haven't read Edmund Spencer in a long time, but apparently Keats was very taken with Spencer's Fairy Queen, which I know we don't read in the curriculum, but, you know, must have been terrifically influential on him.
Yeah, and those fairies, where they come up all the time, even in some of the other poems you get.
Yeah.
Fairyland, the magical casements.
And the ode to a nightingale.
Right.
Yeah, next to the last stanza. Right. Magic casements opening on the foam. What is it? A perilous seas and fairylands forlorn. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And in that same poem, he describes fancy as a deceiving elf. Seems like these medieval images permeate Keats's imagination, even if he's not necessarily setting a poem in an explicitly medieval setting. He just sort of has these motifs.
Yeah, it's as though that's a whole space of his imagination where he tends to go, you know, when he gets to a certain kind of emotional state. It's really interesting. Well, and the Eve of St. Agnes, as you're saying, has all these motifs of lords and ladies and courtly romance and so on. But, you know, also just, you know, almost a kind of modern dimension, even in Porphyro's trick, you know, that he plays, hiding in the closet and substituting himself for the supposed dream. You want to say a little more about what you meant at the outset when you were talking about the difference between the dream and the reality that Madeline seems to experience when she wakes and sees poor cold Porphyro kneeling there?
Yeah, I'm thinking about stanza 34 when we're told that the vision of her sleep, now wide awake, the vision of her sleep, there was a painful change that nigh expelled the bliss of her dream so pure and deep, at which fair Madeline began to weep and mourn forth witless words with many a sigh, while she's looking at Porphyro.
Yeah.
Right. So there's this
Porphyro there.
He at least in this the initial moment, he's not living up to his own dream self. She says, give me that voice again, my Porphyro. Those looks immortal, those complainings dear.
Oh, right.
Eternal woe. Yeah, so the voice that was in my dream, give that to me again. But yeah, the mortal man doesn't live up to the dream man.
Then he melts into her dream, which is, you know, the turn in the poem, it seems like. That's right. They run away shortly after that. He calls her his bride. Is Madeline, And there's that almost uncanny escape from the castle, you know, where the dog is asleep, the porter is drunk and fallen asleep. So everything kind of cooperates to let them escape. And then there's that sudden shift in time at the end, you know, so this suddenly becomes ages and ages ago. It's all very wonderfully done. I just, you know, there are things about Keats's writing that just struck me again. I realized, you know, rereading this poem, which I haven't read, I don't remember reading it in several decades, but certain details would just jump at me. And I'd think, oh my gosh, that's what a fantastic image. The way that Keats imagines something, like, you know, when they're leaving the house, and the door opens, and the heiress, this is stanza 40, the heiress, rich with horsemen, hawk and hound, fluttered in the besieging wind's uproar, and the long carpets rose along the gusty floor. I mean, Keats is, you know, even imagines the wind getting under the carpets, and you kind of, you know, see that ripple of wind as it goes under them. Or earlier in the poem, when Porphyro is heading for Madeline's bedroom, and his the plume that he's wearing on his hat brushes the cobwebs, and it just kind of takes the whole, you know, you just have a sense of the space, because Keats has such a thorough imagination of whatever it is that he's writing about. Pretty wonderful. Yes. So what did you do with La Belle Dame Sans Merci in terms of the medieval sense of things? What were you thinking about the relation, say, to Rime of the Ancient Mariner?
In that one, in the rhyme of, with respect to the Rime of the Ancient Mariner, I was really struck by the conversational element and the conversation between someone in distress and someone who's not. Although here you actually have the reverse. It's this speaker, whoever the speaker is, who actually approaches the knight and is attempting to draw the knight out in conversation, as opposed to the mariner who verbally assaults his chosen victims.
That's right. Yeah.
It made me think of Chaucer's Book of the Duchess.
Interesting.
Honestly, this dynamic of a sad knight. It's a dream vision, and the dreamer sees a knight who is distressed, and it's the dreamer's persistent questions that draw the knight into conversation. And eventually, the knight confesses that he's lost his lady, he's lost his love. I think there's something kind of Chaucerian, perhaps, about this.
Yeah, and the fairy's child that the knight meets out in the meadows seems such a figure of strange enchantment and betrayal, in the sense that she leaves him there. You know, it's as though he's taken into this wonderful, a magical experience, but then left, you know, bereft of it after she leaves him, and he wakes on the cold hillside. I don't know. It reminds you of sort of the world that you get in Tolkien to some extent, to some of the feeling of Sir Gawain and the Green Knight. You know, that last green chapel and all those things. I mean, these strange spaces of fairyland that Keats is able to evoke.
I was thinking of Sir Orfeo, which is another popular medieval romance in which the character travels into fairyland, and there's all of these eerie visions of people who are kind of alive, but they're depicted in their moment of death. So it's this very strange and very gruesome, very unsettling kind of place. Like Fairyland is not really a place that it's not a place for human habitation.
It's, you know, it's as though there's some way that it touches into human life, but it's pretty devastating in its effects, it seems like.
Yeah.
At least for the night here.
Yeah, it is. And I was really struck by the lady's, her sadness, that she's weeping and sighing. And that seems to, I don't know, it seems to add a sort of a level of emotional depth to Fairyland, which is not necessarily always overtly hostile to the world of men, but sometimes just indifferent to the world of men. Right? It's sort of parallel to the world of men. Here we've got her weeping. Keats seems to make her have some kind of emotional complexity, perhaps.
Yeah, almost as though she's weeping about something impossible in this, you know, in this relationship of lovers, one of whom is human, mortal, the other of whom is this other kind of being, it almost seems. You know, maybe the sadness of some of the things you get in Greek mythology, say, you know, even to think back to the Iliad, Thetis is immortal, and her husband Peleus is now an old man. You get that in Tennyson's poem, Tithonus, you know, the one who marries the dawn, who is ever youthful and immortal. I don't know, you feel some of that, strange tension of the relation between these two different realms of being and what happens when they're brought together. I wonder if that's, you know, if that's part of her sadness. But yeah, I mean, his is being bereft of that world. But what is hers? That's a great question.
Yeah, her wildness.
Well, maybe. Yeah. Her wild eyes.
Yeah, that can't. Yeah. United with the human. That's part of her. That's part of her allure, but it can't be tamed.
I wonder if that's not part of Keats's sense of the poetic world of the imagination, also. You know, there's a way that you can get into it and be intoxicated by it, but its relation to the ordinary everyday world is pretty vexed. You kind of get that in the Ode to the Nightingale, you know, where he escapes from himself temporarily into the nightingale, and then those last words, forlorn. The very word is like a bell to toll me back from thee to my soul self. You know, this sense of, as you mentioned earlier, the fancy cannot cheat so well. Like there's maybe some relation between the world of the fancy or the poetic otherness of experience and the world that has the light of common day, you know, as Wordsworth puts it in the Immortality Ode.
Yeah, I think that ties in with, or that seems to be what's happening with Madeline in St. Agnes.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, the visionary, imaginative dream world has such purity that the waking out of that.
Right. It's just almost intolerable. Right. Yeah. And I mean, Keats in his letters is so vividly helpful. Just in thinking about the nature of the imagination, the nature of the poet, all those things. I'm glad that you found that letter yesterday and realized it wasn't in our packet. Because that's the one that I guess I go back to most, where he talks about the poet as not being himself. He doesn't have a self. He's always in something else, you know, and taking on some other identity. entering into the Nightingale or entering
Madeline,
into
the characters. Angela, the old lady. Yeah, he brilliantly depicts this fearful, loving, reluctant, kind of maidenly horror of the old lady really beautifully. He's that chameleon who can enter into.
Yeah,
I also really love that letter, and that's why I was looking for it. And I think that it's helpful to point to Keats's distinction between this Wordsworthian or egotistical sublime and the poetical character that he depicts himself as having. He seems to think that Wordsworth is interested in subjectivity of himself. And that's what he wants to explore. And Keats, there's a kind of, self-abnegation in his understanding of the poet. Pauline, I died to myself and I live to Christ. I die to myself. But for Keats, you live to everything else.
I mean, he's so interesting when he talks about, when he's in a room full of people, he says, not myself goes home to myself, which means, I forget that I'm there and I just kind of take on the identity of everybody else. And more or less taken up in what they're talking about and who they are. And he said it would be the same if he went into a room of school children. So, and, it's just such a wonderful sense of, the malleability of his own identity as a poet. And I think he has to be thinking about Shakespeare when he makes that comment about negative capability, of being capable of being in uncertainties, mysteries, and doubts without any irritable reaching after fact and reason. So it's like you give over your imagination to whatever it is you're in without trying to justify it to your intellect. That's a little controversial.
Yeah.
Because, as you mentioned, he's just as happy imagining a villain as a hero. It's just as vivid. That doesn't mean he has no, it's like there's not some sort of moral center, but that's not the first consideration of the imagination, let's say. What do you understand by that? He just doesn't conceive an Iago as an Imogen, the villain as the beautiful heroine.
Yeah, what shocks the virtuous philosopher delights the chameleon poet.
Yeah.
From its relish of the dark side of things any more than from its taste for the bright one, because they both end in speculation. Yeah, it seems as if poetry, the poet is not fundamentally concerned with making sure that we receive, moral lessons, but that we encounter a kind of vivid reality. It's kind of a metaphysical experience more than it is a moral experience. What is this thing, whether it be Iago or Imogen?
Right. To take you fully inside it rather than to have you stand aside and make moral assessments of it. Yeah, I think that's what he's so brilliant at. As is Shakespeare, for that matter. Shakespeare takes you right inside Iago Edmund or Goneril and Regan, whoever we're thinking of there.
I love it. He's compelling. He's compelling.
It's what?
There's something dynamic and compelling about him. Right.
Well, sure. I mean, he has all this energy and intelligence and sees things much more clearly than others do. Ye gods, stand up for bastards, it's Edmund's line. So, he's not taking anything for granted in a way that other people are, in a kind of complacent conventionality.
Yeah.
But okay, if we probably should wrap up this conversation, but I look forward to many more this semester. What do you think is really distinctive about Keats as a poet. I'm glad I asked you that instead of you asking me that.
That's a great question. I suppose maybe this comes out more in the odes, but also he talks about this in the letters as well, that being comfortable with representing polarities, with ecstasy and with melancholy, with something like the nightingale, with the hope of somehow joining this bird, and yet also the reality that's not possible, and holding those tensions together. I think that's maybe part of the negative capability, is that he doesn't irritably reach after fact, irritably try and resolve them into some kind of tight system, but to see these as part of the nature, part of the reality, the human, and also longing for immortality is going to be these polarities that sometimes seem as if they can be resolved, and then other times seem utterly irreconcilable.
Yeah. When I was reading him again this time, I know exactly what you mean with that sense of, you know, not having to try to reconcile everything. He doesn't worry about whether you can get what he's saying into a tidy concept. You know, that's not at all what he's about. I guess I was struck too, particularly reading the odes, but also reading the Eve of St. Agnes. It feels a little younger. I mean, that's weird to say. Mm-hmm. And he wrote all these poems. Most of the poems we're reading, he wrote in 1 year, 1819. And the odes he wrote, you know, in April and May of 1819. And I don't know about you, but I suspect that he already sensed that he was going to be getting ill. There's such a sense of mortality. He doesn't feel hurried. You know, it's not as though he's rushing things, but there's also something about the onset of this kind of poetic inspiration in a couple of months that's almost unprecedented in literature. I mean, these are great odes, and they're among the the high points of English literature. And you know, he wrote La Belle Dame sans Merci, he wrote Eve of St. Agnes sometime that spring, then you know, Ode to Psyche, Ode on a Grecian Urn, Ode to a Nightingale, Ode on Melancholy, and then a couple of months later, The Two Autumn. And there's just such a sense of the completeness of what he writes. You know, each stanza, when you go through Ode to a Nightingale, has this feeling of, you know, inevitability to it, as though it was, you know, it's being said, and it couldn't be said otherwise, and it has its, it's kind of like, excuse me for jumping from thought to thought, but it's like in the letter where he's talking about how the imagery should rise and come into its fullness and then set, you know, not be forced. That's what you feel pretty intensely, I think, with these odes. I'm sorry, I'm going on.
Well, perfection.
Yeah, it really.
There is. It's just.
And To Autumn, you know, which is the last of his really major poems. My gosh, the beautiful way that it moves toward that ending, and gathering swallows, twitter in the skies, and so on. Yeah, it's pretty amazing that this. This young man wrote all this, I think, at the age of 23, and he was dead by the time he was
25.
January of 1821. He had spent the last year of his life, more or less, in Rome, trying to deal with the tuberculosis that started coming on him the same fall that, you know, most of these poems were written. So
that had killed his mother and his brother.
Yes, and his younger brother Tom. Yeah.
And his uncle too, and so it had been.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. So I think. Well, yeah, I think you're right. That sense of death, whether of his death or just the reality of death, adds such a poignancy to everything. Art.
Well, it reminds me of Wallace Stevens' line, "Death is the mother of beauty." Mm. There's some way that that Keats seems to feel that. He's always seeking what's beautiful in these poems, and it's a pretty major achievement.
Right, veiled melancholy.
Well, maybe we'd. Yeah, that's right.
Temple of delight.
The buried. Veiled melancholy hath her sovereign shrine.
I have been half in love with easeful death. That line just kills me every time I read it.
Yeah. Call them soft names and many amused rhyme. Yeah, I find I have lots of these memorized. I realized at one point in my life that I knew the whole Ode to a Nightingale without ever having tried to memorize it. I didn't ever intentionally do it, and I did the whole thing. So, yeah, it's just there. So that's what this poetry is like.
Poetry is distinctly out of style in our day, and that's a pity. As T.S. Eliot noted, poetry may make us from time to time a little more aware of the deeper, unnamed feelings which form the substratum of our being, to which we rarely penetrate. For our lives are mostly a constant evasion of ourselves. That is, poetry can bring us face to face with ourselves. Perhaps this insight into Keats' poem, The Eve of St. Agnes, can be an invitation for you to begin reading more poetry. For Wyoming Catholic College, this is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz.